Well, it is a great pleasure this morning to interview Edward Owen. And Edward, we were at university together, but I don't think our paths crossed in those days.
No, they didn't. Interestingly enough, I meet many people I was in Lambton with whose paths I never crossed, including in my first clerical job, a member of the choir who did exactly the same course as me, and I never, ever, ever met her. So I think Lampeter is that sort of place. Although there weren't that many students there, it was smaller than the secondary school I went to, there were still lots of people you didn't meet who were there until many, many years later.
And I'm glad you said that, because I've just been reflecting on how, despite the fact that Lampeter was such a small, very intimate place, and you know, we didn't need mobile phones in those days, because we'd always see the same people seven times a day, but there were always people who, through reunions, and of course we've met through the reunion connections, people who were very much part of the Lampeter culture, but our paths somehow never crossed until now, almost as though destiny has said, you know, it's not your time, your time will come. Yeah. And of course, we've now managed to catch up. And we have lots of mutual friends, of course, including someone I interviewed yesterday I went to school with. So it's those 6 degrees of separation, or maybe 1 degree in Lampeter's case.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating, because I look across the course. I mean, the person you interviewed yesterday, who's also one of my parishioners, I mean, it is a very small world. Someone else you know that you're seeing later works in the diocese with me. It is interesting, the 6 degrees of separation, how it works, and how even across, I mean, Wales is, they often say, a small place, but even across the whole of the UK, and in many cases the whole of Europe, the degrees of separation we find are so small, and so many common memories and mutuality, and all sorts of things, even on occasions if you didn't meet them at the time.
Yeah. And so we did similar degrees, I think, was it 2 years apart? Yes. So we were in the same department. You were 93, is that right?
Yes.
To 96.
No, 92 to 95.
So we were 1 year apart.
One year apart.
So we were probably in the same classes, but didn't realise it. Yeah. And do you want to say a little bit about what you do now?
Well, at the moment, I am a vicar in the South Cardiff Ministry area. So it is the most multicultural area of Wales. Grangetown is probably the only truly multicultural community in Wales, because it contains people from so many different communities. And we have two churches in Grangetown, a church in Bute Town and a church in Splott. And I was appointed originally as just the vicar of Grangetown, and then in January 2022, the Diocese of Llandaff was reorganised into ministry areas. So we formed a group with Bute Town and Splott, and we have lots of commonalities between the communities. They are very mixed communities, very diverse communities that contain people from all over the world. Interesting, the largest group of incomers into this community in the last few years have been first language Welsh speakers from North Wales. So the community is changing. It's had a frequent turnover of people, and it's probably the only community I've lived in since living in a university where the only thing most people have in common is they didn't come from here.
And of course, in your case, you're South Wales, is that right?
South Wales, yes.
In fact, am I right in thinking, you may be far too modest to talk about this, but I saw a photograph that you once put on social media, and you referred to, and I thought, those are rather famous people, and I thought, you know, what is the connection? Do you want to say a little bit about that?
So Richard Burton was my grandmother's brother. They came from Pontrydyfen. I met him once, and I was about 3 at the time, I think. I met, and he was with Elizabeth Taylor, and there's that photo that was taken of me in my grandmother's front room, which looks like a typical grandmother's front room in the 1970s in the valleys. And, I met Elizabeth Taylor some years later after he had died, was sitting in my grandmother's front room again. And one day I went to see my grandmother, and Anthony Hopkins was sitting in her front room. So she knew quite a few people from the acting world. And it is a strange thing. I had an aunt who is an actress as well. And it's a strange sort of place to come from, the Port Talbot area, because so many people have gone into the acting profession.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say then that Catherine Zeta-Jones used to mow her lawn or something
No, I've never met Catherine Zeta-Jones.
But how did you end up at Lampeter? Because
how did I end up at Lampeter? Well, I originally was supposed to go to Hull. And I went to Hull and I looked at it and I didn't like it very much. And I came back and I thought, where on earth shall I go? And I looked around and somebody suggested to me, and I can't even remember who it was now, why don't you give Lampeter a try? And the vicar of the parish where I grew up in had gone to Lampeter. At that time, most of the church in Wales had been to university in Lampeter. And so I went with no preconceptions, and it worked for me. So I was very pleased that I went. I could have gone to other places. And lots of my friends went to Manchester. But I went to have a look at it, and I really didn't fancy it.
Yeah, it was a similar story here. I mean, my sister had been at Lampeter before me. In fact, our paths crossed there. But as we've just been discussing, a small place can yield both lifetime friendships, but also the surreal possibility, 30 years on, of meeting people for the first time. So for a place that small, I think that it punches far above its weight.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that in both professions that I've been a part of, both teaching and Anglican ministry, there's a very heavy Lampeter connection, both with people who seem to go into teaching first and then later end up in ordained ministry, and in a few cases the other way around. It's interesting how those connections work, and they're multi-generational as well, which is fascinating. How Lampeter was once perceived as a sort of college for vicars when Burgess Hall was there, and the generations in the church in Wales that have gone through that system, and actually, interestingly enough, are continuing to do so. And that's what I find fascinating. Although there are fewer clergy now than there once were, a lot of them are still going through Lampeter as a pathway, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and certainly through Church in Wales conferences.
Yes.
And I do recall back in the 90s as well, I might even have been there at the time, certainly various synod events and sort of in terms of the ordination of women, for example.
The vote on the ordination of women, I think when it got through, was in the Arts Hall in Lampeter. And it was fascinating. I was actually in that debate, although I've never been a member of the governing body. It's a fascinating part of how things connect up. And it was very strange. When I met my second wife, I hadn't been back to Lampeter probably 15 years, although I only lived 50 miles away at the time. But it was just not... Unless you're going there, it's not the sort of place you go. And she happened to say that actually one of her relatives was buried in the churchyard in Lampeter, and her grandmother had grown up in Lampeter. So it's strange how those connections sort of filter and come in, and it's that sort of place, I think.
And do you find that after those 15 years, because it was the same with me, I think I went away for 16 years before I felt ready to return. But there's always that debate in terms of the context of nostalgia, the place... And the time or the people. And a lot of people I know won't go back because they say it's changed too much. And they know that the dissonance between what they remember then and what they see now will be heartbreaking. But in your case, is it very much the people from the time? Is it the place, the buildings, what you studied? What are the sort of... What's the hub?
I suppose the hub is the people. It was Duncan, who I shared a bungalow with in Tŷ Glyn for 2 years, which did take us sort of off the main campus. And we hadn't seen one another, I think, for 20 years. And he messaged me, it was 2017, it was the year I'd become Vicar of Margam. And he said to me, I'm going to go this year because I've only been there once since I've left, because he lived in the northeast of England, so it wasn't like a pop down the road. And I went back, I suppose, to see him. I met many other people I knew there at the time. And the buildings and the things were interesting, and some things seemed to me to be radically changed, and other things seemed to me to be exactly the same. So it's been an interesting journey. And what was fascinating was that when we were under COVID restrictions and we were finally allowed to go out, so to speak, part of the problem we had in Wales with the county-wide lockdowns was that we lived in Margam at the time, Bow Talbot. We weren't able to go east. The only way we could go was west. So we actually ended up going out to Lampeter because it was one of the few places where we were able to and fancied going. And I can remember sitting as the lockdowns were sort of, these restrictions were easing, having a takeaway coffee from Conti's and thinking, wow, this is surreal and strange. And it was for about 5 weeks on my day off, which at that time was a Saturday, we used to drive down west because it was the only place we could go. And it was fascinating that I probably went to Lampeter more over the course of 2 or 3 months than I had done in 25 years. And it was an amazing thing to look and to see and to perceive and to see how it had changed, as indeed everywhere changes, but also how it had remained the same.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people want to let it be. They want to remember the place as it was, maybe look at the photographs. And change can be difficult, but change can bring, as I have found over the last few years, that you know, we change with a place, perhaps. And in some places we don't change. And I was joking when I said that you see lots of people who are around 50, but you still see them as 20.
Yeah.
You know, there's a 20-year-old and a 50-year-old body. But change can bring all sorts of possibilities. And I think that the community element that was always there, and something you just took for granted when you were 18 or 19. You know, it's a small Welsh Wales place, but people from all over the world congregated there. Because I find I now work in Canterbury, and there are lots of students who are local. They come from the immediate areas, the immediate counties, or South London. But in Lampeter, people did travel, not just from other parts of England or Scotland, but literally, you know, in one evening, I think there was one night when I spoke to somebody from New Zealand, the next person was from Germany, the next person was from Canada. And I thought, you know, that would never happen, maybe outside of London, that would never happen in any other university.
No, no, and I think that was one of the most fascinating aspects of it, was it drew people who ordinarily and otherwise would probably never have met. And I think that was part of its charm. And talking to other friends whose experience of university was not as positive, who went to much larger places in larger cities, they had no core almost that they connected to. It was a very disparate and dissolute experience. Whereas I couldn't go back for a long time because of the various circumstances in life and things I was up to, and when I finally went back, it was a very liberating thing. I had a similar experience with the school I used to teach in Ebbw Vale, and my occasion for going back was actually when the school was closing, and it had been a number of years since I'd left there. And I'd been back once since then, when I happened to be driving past, and the roads had completely changed on the heads of the valley, and all that was left of the school was actually a flat site, because the school had been demolished, because they joined five schools up into what they euphemistically call a super school. And it was interesting to stand there and actually look at what had been 7 years of my life and see nothing left. And I think sometimes you have to cherish things for what they are. And nostalgia is important, but it's important for your own development and your own moving forward, not as a desire just to look back with rose-tinted spectacles, but actually to process the different periods and eras of your life. It's strange because when I can't say I universally feel the same about everywhere I go back to, because sometimes you can look at a place you were heavily invested in, and I did this in one of my former parishes. I went back for the funeral of somebody I'd known really well and had a lot to do with, and I looked at the place and it's almost like I've never been here. And life had moved on, and they'd moved on, and they had, I think they were two vicars subsequent to me at that point. But when I go back to Lampeter, it is as if I've always been there. And that's a very, very, very strange thing.
There is that notion of home, because when I started doing this project on nostalgia, and there's no doubt that Lampeter was the impetus for that, it's that sort of notion of homesickness, really, but the notion of home. And I could never quite work out whether it was the place or the people, but it was actually meeting former Lampeter friends, well, not for former students who I'd fallen out of contact with, but met again in Cardiff, not very far from where we are here now. And that was an eye-opener, because I suddenly realised that we were picking up from where we left off in 1994. And then that's when it really struck me that those bonds, because we all chose Lampeter. I always use the analogy of being in a school where there are 30 students, 30 pupils in a class, 29 of them would want to go to a big city. Many of my school friends went to Cardiff. But there's always going to be one for whom Lampeter is the place. The other 29 will think, why would you want to go there? But if all of those one people, you know, pupils in every single class were to go to Lampeter, then Lampeter is a place of very like-minded people. No doubt very neurodiverse, but suddenly, though the reasons why they were brought there, even those who went through clearing, and I've spoken to many of those who then said that, you know, Lampeter took them on and now they're professor of geography at wherever, So the place has a particular appeal. And I don't think I've ever encountered that to the same extent anywhere else.
No. I would agree with you. It's a place of... I suppose it's one of those things, and I see it a little bit in this community in South Cardiff in Grangetown, where the community is very intentional, because you're all thrown in for a particular reason. And other than being there, probably you don't have that much in common. But you find what you have in common. And I think that experience is very, very rich. And that's probably something unique that it has to contribute. And I think, to a degree, its isolation and where it is actually one of its greatest strengths. I mean, it's interesting. I have been a rural parish priest for a comparatively short period, about 4.5 years. And I can't say it particularly was my scene. And I love the countryside, yet for most of the last 25 years I've lived in very heavy urban environments, and I've actually actively chosen to be an inner city parish priest in a very, very inner city area, which is very interesting. And I actually think that the character of inner city Cardiff and the character of Lampeter have actually more in common than the character of some of the towns that I've worked in. And it's that thing of intentional community that draws people together because they don't have a kinship connection, or they haven't always been there. And they won't always remain there. And I think that is an important thing. But along with nostalgia, it's part of the sort of... Because I deal in essential... as a priest, I deal in stories... be they sort of great religious stories or the stories of people's lives. And really, in nostalgia, we're dealing with stories and perceptions, aren't we? And it's how you perceive a story to be that is actually where you get the learning from it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of putting it. Because as a priest, do you find that nostalgia can be a challenging thing?
Yes.
Is there too much of the sort of, oh, those were rosy days?
Yeah, there is a lot of those were rosy days, but that's a. I mean, I've worked in far too many parishes, but that has been a common thing. But they are gold. Very often, they're misrememberings, and people will remember one or two key events, which were packed with people of every generation. You know, everything was full, and it was all wonderful, and it was marvellous, and it was like that all the time. But when you interrogate the narrative, you find that the truth was actually very different. Mm. And when I was vicar of Margam Abbey, they would tell me how there were hundreds there in the 1970s and the 60s and the 50s. And as an interesting exercise, I took all the service registers and had a hunt through them and found that the average attendance was actually lower then than it was when I was there. And so the rememberings were of certain key events, and sometimes there is a captivity to the past, but it's not a real past. And it was St. Augustine who said, and quite marvelously, you know, do not look back to the past and think, oh, you'd rather be there, because that had its challenges too, and the challenges you face today are the challenges that God has given you. And there is a sense that as we journey through life, if we don't take the opportunity to learn, which is where nostalgia can be a very positive thing, we keep on making the same mistakes again and again and again.
Yeah, and I find that because I keep a diary, I've kind of got the best of both worlds, or the worst of both worlds, because I've got a record from the events concerned.
Yeah.
It may be a very, you know, relative to the amount that I write now, very, very piecemeal. But some of the things that are momentous from today's point of view that I reflect on might have had an inconsequential entry in the diary. On the other hand, I might be writing about things that somehow, you know, from the point of view of now, just seem completely inconsequential. So there is always that sense of perspective. But sometimes I think we need that, maybe misremembering isn't the right word, but sometimes there is a sense in which it's comforting for us to know that there was a place and there were people where we felt a sense of belongingness.
Yes.
Though in reality, if we hadn't gone down the student union bar on a particular night, maybe we would have encountered a different set of people and we wouldn't have had that same sense of belonging. But something clicked, and it clicked for 3 years.
Yes.
And that can be life-changing.
Yes. Yeah, I think that sense of belonging is a magnificent thing.
Yeah.
And it's one of the greatest problems as a religious profession in today's society is the atomization of society, where people have become very individualistic, not because they are selfish, but because they are scared and they are anxious. And one of the greatest problems I deal with in ministry is people's anxiety, not least my own. But you deal with people who become afraid of other people. And that's not just true of the inner city, that's true in every community that I've worked in. And actually that sense of belonging, that sense of having a common narrative and a common structure is one of the greatest challenges that society faces. And in a sense, with the decline in religious belief of which was in this country predominantly Christian, because that common narrative has gone, that sense of community, and be it churches or be it Rotary clubs or Freemasons or any other form of community society, has all those have sort of declined and diminished. We've lost a sense of common narrative, and part of the challenge of the church is to help to rebuild that common narrative for people's good. I mean, it's very interesting serving in a multicultural inner city community, because it's still a place where religion has sway and is a marker of identity and actually matters. And that is a fascinating thing.
Yeah, and are you known to and respected by members of the non-Christian members of the community?
We are known. It's early days in building interfaith relationships because of the COVID pandemic, which I came in the midst of. But there is, we did an interfaith walk several weeks ago. There is a desire to understand, and we do some work with the Joe Cox Foundation, the More in Common Partnership and the Great Get Together. And it's trying to bring people together who are different. Because in a sense, the challenge of bringing people together who are the same isn't that great. There is a tremendous, in my church communities, there is a tremendous sense of belonging. And although we are, what I would say, reasonably diverse in terms of church community, we're mixed age, mixed social class, mixed educational backgrounds, we are predominantly white, with a few exceptions. We have a few people from the BAME community, but not very many. But we are people who are largely the same, and we have that sense of belonging, but we don't actually reflect really the larger community around us. And that's a challenge to get people into that sense of belonging to one another. I do a lot of work with Citizens UK, a community building organisation, and they speak a lot about getting people to understand enlightened self-interest. So they work alongside people very different to themselves because they have a common cause. And in a sense, if we're healthy, we should all be self-interested, interested in ourselves. And it's working out how you pursue that in an enlightened way to work alongside as many people who are different to yourself. And I think actually Lampeter probably did that, because we had the religious studies department, we had the Islamic studies centre there, and we were pushed against a lot of people who were very different to ourselves. That was a tremendous thing. You know, there was tremendous learning in that. I mean, I'd love to go back and do it all again with the experience I've had, because it would be an even richer experience now.
Yeah, I always wonder if we were to go back, would we do this, make the same mistakes again? And perhaps also it's not a bad thing if we do.
No.
Because somehow if we went through life all making wonderful decisions, well, we would have no sort of yardstick against which to measure anything.
No.
What sort of character building would that be?
No. And I think part of the challenge of being human and being alive is that sense of making mistakes and learning from them and developing as a human being. I think that's really important. And lots of the work that I've done in sort of conflict reconciliation and mediation and in community building is actually getting people to acknowledge their mistakes, because in mediation things only ever work when both parties admit, yeah, we're both a bit wrong. And I think sometimes seeing our own wrongness is sometimes a marvellous thing. It helps us to develop, it helps us to grow, it helps us to change. And we live in a world where we need nostalgia, because nostalgia is the thread that runs through that actually really and does enable us to change, because we have a sense of where we're coming from, although we never know where we're going to. But we have that sense of... But we need to revisit, and the revisiting is important.
Yeah, because I had done a project on the future, on eschatology.
Yes.
before the nostalgia one, so I suppose very sort of Maltmanian, Pannenbergian, you know, sort of looking at the doing things sort of back to front. But I just see them as different sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Because with nostalgia, and it's 2 days before Christmas as we're talking now, that there is an obvious sense that people are looking at, you know, childhood, Christmas is past, yes. and the quote innocence from that. But at the same time, it's the rebuilding of that, because that can be done in a very dangerous way. We think of Trump America, of course, make America great again, the word again perhaps being the crucial word there. But also that sense in which it's setting a foundation. And I suppose there is something pre-lapsarian, very Adam and Eve in that as well, about the sense of, are we trying to regain innocence? Is there a sense that that's what we crave? Is that what we desire? I'm not sure it is. And I think having a diary that shows me the different shades from that period doesn't make me any less inclined to want to go back to the past. If anything, it makes me want to go back even more, because I suddenly realise that there are layers that perhaps I was unaware of at the time, that in later years, and perhaps through those conversations with people, you realise that they've changed, but they haven't changed at the same time.
Yes, I think there's a tremendous... It's a sort of... It's in a sense like being human and recalling your first love for things, whatever they were. I mean, it was interesting yesterday. It's my father's sharpener. My father's 89 and lives in the same house we grew up in, and he's very good for 89, but nevertheless, he is 89. And he doesn't travel at Christmas, so he won't come to us for Christmas. And I, for many years, I went back on my own because my wife was with other members of the family. And in the end, he said to me, look, it really is a lot of effort. It's fine. It's no problem. But I was very struck yesterday as I took him home shopping and we went back to the house and got everything ready for Christmas for him. That over Christmases when I was a child, he always worked. So Christmas Day is as nothing to him. He's not a particularly religious person. So he's quite befuddled. His son is an Anglican priest. But it's interesting that continuity. I look at the house, and it was the house I grew up in, and the experiences that I had in that place were formative to the person I am now, and I can see the continuity, and I can remember my dad when he was my age now, and you have all of those threads that hold everything together, but yet now it is different. And I think that sense of continuity is important, and sometimes as things change, it can make us quite scared and it can make us a bit reluctant. But it also can show our deepening maturity as well. Because in a sense, we only ever get any better by embracing what is difficult.
Yeah.
It's only by walking towards resistance and walking towards challenge and difficulty that we actually grow. And that aspect of life is a particularly important one. And it's about being able to hold the threads together. And that's particularly important, I think. Holding the threads of continuity together. And you know, when we go back to reunions, yes, we go back in some ways to who we were at 18, 19, 20, 21. But we do it with the experience of people who are nearly 50, in my case. And it is a tremendous thing, actually, to join those threads back up again.
Yeah, and I find as well that the way that our parents' perception of us changes, or our perceptions of our parents changes. So you mentioned that it's a source of great surprise to your father that you're an Anglican priest. But is there scope for dialogue there? In other words, when you went, you did, was it history and theology?
Philosophy and theology.
Philosophy and theology. So when you went to university to study those subjects, obviously it's easy now in retrospect to say, the seeds of what doing now were there. Were they obvious to you? Were they obvious to your family at that time?
I think they were obvious to me. They were less obvious to my family. My father worked in industry, and my father's desire was for me to be an accountant, because he thought accountancy is a nice, clean job and they earn lots of money. I am completely innumerate, so it would probably have been the worst profession I could have followed. And when I became a teacher, he could see the usefulness, social utility in me being a teacher, because all his brothers and sisters had started off as teachers. So he saw the value in that. When I was in my early 30s and I said I'm leaving teaching and going into ministry, he was completely dumbfounded by that, because he said, that's rather daft, you know, Christianity really, you know, it's a minority interest in society, will you end up with a proper full-time job? And I have, in the last 18, 19 years, fortunately, been in the position where I have been. So I think the seeds were sown in me a long time before that. Lampeter was a good place to develop it because there were many cultures, and the Christian culture in Lampeter was actually quite wacky in many ways. And I learned a lot from that. I met many people from the evangelical tradition of the church that I'd never met before. And that's, whilst that's certainly not where I'm at and never where I have been at, I learned much from them. But I think the foundational thing I take from Lampeter is that it's fine to be yourself. And you know, we were in college with many people who could politely be described as eccentric. And some of them have remained just as eccentric, if not more so. And some of them, I wonder where they are, and have never been able to trace them or find any sign of them on social media or anywhere in the world or on the internet or anywhere. And that's been a tremendous thing, been a fascinating thing.
Yeah, and I was reflecting on that with the individual that I talked to yesterday, and how back in the 1980s, being different or perceived as different, yeah, as if there's some sort of standard that somebody embodies, yes, as if the bullies in the playground somehow were the normal people and anybody else had to be pushed into alignment with their way of looking at things. Back in those days, conformity seemed the right thing. In fact, I often wondered if that was what education was about. When I was at school, did I necessarily at the time think it was a place for learning, or did I see it as a place for you know, you were told off if you walked on the wrong way up the stairs, that sort of thing. That's my abiding memory of being 11 or 12. But going to Lampeter and meeting lots of neurodiverse people, and including myself in that, suddenly there is that sense of acceptance. And years later, I think that kind of, as somebody once said to me, that's the superhero, that's the superpower of being different. Being eccentric means that sometimes you're able to be carried along. You're able to do things that other people can't do. You're able to take risks. You're able to stand out.
Yes.
In those days, you didn't want to stand out from the crowd.
Yes.
But now you can stand out from the crowd. And that's not a bad thing to do when you're in your 40s or 50s, when sometimes you perhaps need to take charge in a situation.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the strengths it's given me, certainly in what I do as a profession, is I probably come from, you know, I am probably the antithesis of the shiny, assured, alpha-style Christian in their nice chinos and expensive Borden jackets. In a sense, I am probably... whilst I'm not, I would say, old-fashioned would be a wrong word to describe it. I'm probably quite an old-school parish priest that still trudges the pavement and wears a collar and dresses in black and is called Father. And in community, the sort of communities that I've worked in, probably with the exception of one, which was deep countryside and very affluent, that as a method of working actually has reaped results, because I've worked in such relational communities where being a community figure is important and where things like management and strategy are less important. And I think part of my own eccentricity, for want of another word, has been in a very gentle way to stand out against that culture and to say, well, actually, what matters is love and pastoral care. And yes, we might not have the most slick strategy in the world. We might not have the largest number of people in the world. But what we aim to do is have as much love as we can possibly manage. And we welcome and we accept people. And we accept that not everybody's going to get what this is about, and not everybody's going to be a super-duper trained disciple, and that doesn't really matter.
Yeah. And one of the things that I used to do at Lampeter, and I suppose I was interested in this at school as well, archiving things, recording things off the radio. At the time, I certainly couldn't have imagined that 30-odd years on I'd still be listening to those, or that they might have some utility, or at least as I see it. But in terms of the sort of the artifacts of the past, maybe the music, the films, and particularly come from Port Talbot, where obviously there's a great sort of filmic and theatrical sort of setup, is that something that's been very important to you?
I think probably there are certain key albums that I remember, and I can remember at the time what I was doing when I listened to them. And occasionally, to mitigate the boredom if I'm on the treadmill, and thanks to the glory of YouTube, I listen to them on my phone. And it's interesting how you journey through life with the music, and how certain things you you revisit that you haven't been able to revisit for a long time. Certain feelings and emotions that come through those things, almost a bit like watching, you know, sort of, I'm thinking of Alibi and Drama, those two TV channels that sort of contain lots of old detective and mystery programs and crime programs. And sometimes if you watch them and you haven't seen them for 30 years, they take you back and transport you to another place. And sometimes they make you wish I had more time to sit down and watch television. And there's something wonderful about that. And you look back in many ways at a certain, I suppose, innocence and naivety that you once had. And that is a joy. That really is a joy. Sometimes it's painful, but most of the time it's joyful.
I mean, do you find that you're transported back to that younger iteration of yourself? Or is it a case that you're revisiting it, maybe being sort of self-critical of the you from those days?
I think in some ways, yeah, there's a partly revisiting, but it's more a looking back and a sort of self-criticism. More over things that I wish I'd done sooner. Some things I wish I hadn't done. Some places I wish I hadn't lived, and some experiences I wish I hadn't had. But you have to get to a stage where you feel able to do that. I think, I never ever regret going to Lampeter. There are some aspects of my time that I would have done differently. I probably would not have lived out in Teaglen and Killyireland, because that separated me off from the community. Some of the decisions I made subsequent to that, I would have made differently. But then if I'd made those decisions differently, we might not be sitting here having this interview today. So I certainly am very glad to do what I do in the place that I do it with the people I do it with. And that's not saying that it's easy, because it's not. But I think the sum total of my experiences have added up to where I am now. And for that, I am thankful.
Yeah, and I've been talking about this quite a lot over friends over recent days, and that sense almost that we may not have been, maybe destiny is the wrong word to use, but predetermined maybe, I don't know, but we went to certain places at certain times, but if we hadn't gone to those places, if A-level results had gone a different way or there'd been a different set of options open to us, would we all have found ourselves sort of back together again eventually? In other words, is there a sense in which the paths, because of the particular alignment, and Lampeter, I think, fosters this because it was a very arts and humanities-based place, but somehow we all, even if it's not in the 1990s, maybe in the 2020s or beyond, there's a sense in which somehow those paths are bound to cross because of the same networks of people and the sort of interest that you never really lose, whatever your life situations.
Yes, I think some of my friends from school I was in sixth form with, who I'm still in touch with, and again, I probably reconnected to some of them about the same time that I reconnected with the Lampeter reunion, went to universities in large cities and did not have those experiences. And I'm in touch with virtually nobody they were in university with. I have no desire to go back there or revisit it or any of those type of things. And my wife, who went to quite a small college to do a teacher training, still has six very good friends. But that was a very small college, probably about the same size as Lampeter, and her experiences of university initially weren't very good, but her experiences of teacher training were very positive indeed, because of the difference in the environment. One was Birmingham, one was Worcester College of Higher Education. And I think there is a certain dynamic where you have if something is the right size, if it's the right mix of people and in the right location, you get the right dynamic that works for you. And perhaps for some people, the anonymity of being in a big city in a university of thousands upon thousands of people might be something that they find desirable. But I've not met anybody yet who has the close connections because of that.
Yeah, and I think it does work both ways. I remember once in Kent, one student came to see me to say she wanted to leave because the place was too small. She was from London and it was too small. The next student said, "I'm sorry, this place is too big, I want to leave." And I thought, how funny, because those students, they probably crossed, one was leaving my room as the other walked in.
Yeah.
But they both came in, and this was only about a week into the term, so they neither of them had really sort of given the place a chance. But I'm not sure, even for me, I don't think I sort of thought, gosh, Lampeter's a very small place. I came from the city. I came from the outskirts of the city, but I would never really call myself a city boy. Yeah. I was somebody who sort of went where my parents drove me, and you know, I sort of lived a life where a wonderfully sheltered life in so many ways. So I did all my growing up in Lampeter. But I wonder if, am I putting Lampeter on a pedestal because that's the place where the journey kind of came to full fruition? Or is that just sort of an outworking of the sort of person that I am? And that, you know, would I have, I'm sure I would have done well anywhere else, but at that particular time, I kind of feel that Lampeter was a perfect fit.
Yes. I think, having grown up in a rough industrial town with a very sort of macho culture, which I didn't really fit into, I suppose when I got to Lampeter, I realised it was fine for people to be themselves. So there wasn't that degree of external conformity or you get your head kicked in. And I think that was its greatest strength. Whether I would have done as well anywhere else, I don't know. I think... because I could have gone elsewhere, and I didn't. Mm. And quite why that was. Now, it's interesting, you know, sort of in middle age, I've become a city boy. And I love living in the city. I love living in the inner city. I love its diversity. I love its mystery. I love its insanity. And it's really, really interesting. But I couldn't have done this 25 years ago because it would have been considerably out of my comfort zone. I can remember telling people where I was coming after I left my last job, and they all said, "You must be mad, you don't want to go there." And I think Lampeter had that sort of reputation for being in a different way. People would say, "What on earth do you want to go to the middle of nowhere for?" And I remember having a former pupil who went there, and he thrived. He loved it. He absolutely adored it. And when he was making university choices, and I knew him pretty well, I haven't taught him since he was in year seven, "Have a look at this place, it might work for you," because he'd been to look at some city universities and wasn't keen. And ironically, he lives in Cardiff now, not very far from me. But it worked for him, and he stayed on. He did a master's degree, and he was quite an alternative, creative and artsy person. And it brought him a great deal of happiness. And he met his wife there as well. So, was an American. So it does show that the Lampeter attracts these people from all over the world. And yeah, there is that tremendous sense of even if people go to Lampeter and go back to the community that they grew up in and remain there, it has changed them and it's part of their journey.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody, one of the first people I interviewed actually, who's a colleague of mine at work, who said that it's possible perhaps to be nostalgic for things that you didn't do. And that was quite eye-opening for me, because obviously it's easy to think of the things that we did, maybe we regret doing, or the things we should have done more. But actually, to be nostalgic is something that almost at first sight could be seen to be like somebody else's life, or, you know, yes. Well, I didn't do that. But yes, maybe you can grow up a bit and think, yeah, maybe I'm a more confident person now, and maybe I should have asked that person out, or I should have taken that risk and, you know, cultivated various interests that I have. But I find that really intriguing as well, because the nostalgia is obviously going to be part of a communal nexus, because it has to be, because you're sharing something, but you might be sharing it with different communities. I mean, sometimes, and you find this, I'm sure, on Facebook, when suddenly somebody might comment on a post who you know from one part of your life. Yes. It might be a family member. Yes. It might be somebody who works in a coffee shop down the road. It might be somebody you went to university with or school with. But to suddenly have these people almost like commenting on each other's posts, when you realise that the only common denominator is yourself.
Yes.
And then you think, just imagine if they did meet. Who knows what the possibilities might be. There's a novel there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a novel there. I mean, yes, that's... I mean, I think that's... Because what's fascinating is, of course, we were in university at the time when there was no social media. So I wonder, in this social media age, if the experience would be a different experience. Because, I suppose I was an early adopter of social media, because I sort of realised pretty early on that in ministry, social media would work if you were careful with it. And it's become a far more work-based tool, because in a sense, my private Facebook account, for want of a better word, is a work tool as well as everything else, because I mean, I wouldn't put anything on it, I wouldn't want anybody to see, and my life's not so interesting or exciting that I have to anything risque enough to that I couldn't share. But it's interesting, and I wonder, you know, that thing of imagining things you didn't do, if part of the anxiety we see in modern society is because of social media and the wonderful lives that people appear to be living and the wonderful photos that they take, realizing that they are through filters and lenses and only part of a much bigger story. I have had the experience when people have booked baptisms over social media, and I've seen pictures of them, so I imagine who might turn up. And when they turn up, they look completely different because they aren't filtered.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating, because in a sense, we lived life much more in the raw, because, you know, we didn't have mobile phones, we didn't have social media. The only thing we had was our connection with one with another and the common grounds of meeting face-to-face, in person. And I think that might make a difference to the experiences that people wish they didn't have, that they wish they might have had.
Yeah, I do wonder if people are particularly good at filtering. I mean, I suppose I do that. I suppose I'm very careful what I put out on. I mean, sometimes there are lots of, even if I'm out with my children, I don't post pictures of them. So it's like, I'm with my children today, but all you see is me, and multiple pictures of me in particular, in zoos or theme parks or whatever it might be. But I also think that there is a sense in which sometimes we all have that capacity or that need sometimes to be able to put our imprint in a chaotic world and say, this is what I stand for, this is what I want to do. Mm. And some people will be very adept at sometimes putting out their, you know, their personal challenges. That can be awkward. Somebody says, I'm having a really bad day, and then people obviously will say, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that, what's going on? Whereas I'm always more inclined to say that if people want to comment, that's great. But they'll do so voluntarily. They'll do so if they've got the time to do so. And frankly, you know, I'm competing when I put something out there with hundreds, if not thousands, of other people. So what makes my post particularly special? And if somebody goes to the effort of commenting, then I'm very touched by that, because I think, you know, I've made that connection. Often there might be a physical follower. But people are very good at filtering their lives. And I wonder if we've always done that, even in the days before social media. We'd always want to have a particular image that we wanted to present to the world.
Yeah. I think there's probably that public versus private individual stuff, which has, you know, probably been around since the dawn of humanity. And I think there is that aspect of it that, I mean, everybody's life is lived through a filter. And of course, you know, but the very nature that I have a professional uniform, which I dress in probably a bit too much, I find the way that people treat me is completely different when I am sitting here dressed in a clerical collar, black from head to foot, than if I'm out in a running kit or if I'm out in jeans and a t-shirt. And that is a very interesting thing. And there is that public versus private thing that can be challenging. It's interesting because I do a lot of running, and I've always been, I suppose, in the years that I've done it, because I do it in the community, I see it as part of my ministry. So on all my Run Britain rankings and everything, I'm titled as Father. And that's part of me, and I'm known for that. And is that a public side of ministry? Yeah, it is. It is. You know, the chief benefit to it is to myself, because I enjoy doing it, it makes me feel better. But it helps make connection and forms community. And the fascinating thing about our running group in this community is probably the only really multicultural, most diverse running group in Wales, because it contains one person who can run a mile in 4 minutes and 30 seconds to people who would struggle to run a mile in 14 minutes and really are just going marginally faster than walking. And it contains people who are Muslims, who are Christians, who have no religion, people who've lived all over the world. And it's about 25, 30 people. And the only thing that most of us have in common is that we run. But there is that sort of intentionality within it. And I've never been able to go to many of their socials, because they normally fall around major Christian religious festivals when people are off from work and I'm in work. But we decided this time to have a post-Christmas social on the 28th. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes, because we only know one another generally in running kits.
Yeah.
And although two of us have community-style related orientated jobs, so we know one another through that a bit better, all that we have in common is this activity of running around in bad lycra at varying speeds for our abilities.
And do they know that you're a priest?
Oh, yes.
Is that something? Is that sort of the space where you don't almost like promote what you do? Because wearing that uniform.
Yeah, I'm not wearing the uniform. They know I'm a priest because I'm taking this father and all my run stuff. They know in the local park run where I am most weekends, unless I'm park run tourism. They know who I am, they know I'm the local vicar. Two of my running club are the local nonconformist ministers. Another one is a very prominent member of the mosque and actually runs the Grange Pavilion up there, which is where we would have met ordinarily, but it's closed for 11 days for Christmas. That's a wonderful community space where you meet all sorts of people. It's known as my second office, because it's where I spend most of the day sometimes, and people just come back and forth. It is a different space, but I've probably got to the stage here now, being here nearly 2 years, and I run every day. As many people recognise me in a running kit, they recognise me dressed as a clergyman, they don't recognise me in civilian clothes, which is a fascinating thing. So if I really want to be left alone, I just put on jeans and a sweater and wander around, and people will double take and take them 2 or 3 minutes, and I've left the street by the time they've worked out who it is. And that public-private thing is an interesting division.
Yeah, and I think I've breached it, and I'm happy that I breached it, because I was talking to a family member yesterday who said, oh, you know, I know you go to the cinema all the time, but I've just discovered that actually that's part of your job. And I think, well, yes, I've turned my obsessions into a work project.
Yeah. I think life. I've always had what by nature been teaching and ministry are vocational jobs, so they don't have a clear beginning and end date, really, because priesthood is ontological and you have it for life. You know, even if I went off to decide to become a bus driver or a psychotherapist or something else, I'd still be a priest. And in a sense, the priesthood is not defined by being dressed like this. It's in who you are. But it's in a sense, it's work and play and play and work. What is work? What is play? It's just your life. I mean, I can remember being interviewed from a ministerial development review this year, and the archdeacon interviewing me, who's known me since I was probably 14, and I've known him since he was a curate, because he's always been here, said to me, which day of the week do you take off? Well, I said, it doesn't really work like that. I said, because you know, it's just life, and I get on with it, and if we want to go away for a couple of days, ultimately be left in peace, and we've got the freedom and the space, do we go away? But if I'm around, I'm sort of working. And, you know, most of Saturday I spend in a running kit, marshalling the parkrun, or running around the parkrun, or having coffee with people who go to parkrun. And do I do some vicarly things there? Well, yeah, I do, really. That's just life.
Yeah. No, I'm quite conscious that I never switch off. No. When I do, inverted commas, where I'm in a space, maybe a family space in some cases, but where I'm in a different sort of mindset, that's when I find myself becoming almost a bit sluggish sometimes, because suddenly, especially with four young children, I lose the capacity sometimes to be proactive, or suddenly I sort of think, hang on a minute, they're not listening to me.
No.
And suddenly it's like, oh, I don't have the talents for sorting out this situation, but in another situation, I'm very capable of knowing which buttons to press. As we start to wrap up, Edward, I'm just sort of thinking, and perhaps you've already answered this question, but would you say, as you survey your life and career, that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Yes. I think my memories are almost universally predominantly positive. Even on the rough times, I had 4 or 5 very bad years towards the end of the sort of 2000s going into the 2010s. Would I have not have done them? No, I wouldn't have. I would have definitely done them again. There are some decisions I would have made differently. I moved too often, partly because of how I was at the time. Are my memories positive? Yes, they are. I wouldn't be here today sitting having this conversation with you if my memories were positive. Are my greatest wonderings about all the people of our Lamperty years who disappeared and there's no trace of is why? Yeah. And that's my question. And because I've never found any of them to ask them, I'm interested to know what is it to be disappeared in that way? Because it was a part of our lives, an important formative part of our lives. And just to sort of suddenly disappear. And
yeah, I found that actually, that some of the people I was closest to in those days, many of them are still kind of around. They're on Facebook, but they're not my primary friends.
No.
I would say that my primary friends are the people who were more secondary, or in some cases tertiary.
Yes.
Or indeed, they weren't even on the radar in those days.
There's an interesting thing. I did it when I did some stuff on family systems theory. I was doing some training about emotional maturity, and it was about people who practice emotional cutoff. And one of the facilitators who had been in this state in her earlier parts of her life had said, you know, she had nobody from school she remembered, nobody from university she remembered, nobody from previous jobs she'd remembered, because each time she cut them off. Not consciously or deliberately, but it was just something that came from her family background that people did. And part of the challenge of her reaching sort of wholeness and reconciliation was actually starting to reconnect with people and learning that perhaps things weren't as grim as she thought they were. So my sort of wrapping it up with you, my sort of concluding thoughts are a wondering, because life is a wonderful thing, you know, even when things go badly, you know, if we've got the gift of getting up and being alive and we've got somewhere to live and somebody who loves us, life is a wonderful thing, even if it throws challenges at us and makes us insecure and anxious sometimes, it's still a wonderful thing. My wondering is about all those people we know not of, and I hope they're okay and I hope they're doing well and thriving, but I'm just fascinated why they're so just
Yeah, because I suppose there's a sense in which sometimes we expect or we need people to almost be the same. That if they were there then, and they came to us for advice, I suppose obviously they go to other people for advice now. But the fact that they're not on that radar, and yet they once were, because I suppose I don't like to think of friendships in that sort of transactional way. That, you know, and I know people who were like that. They'd be your best friend when they were there, but when they'd encounter another group of friends or they'd go back to their hometowns, they'd forget about you, and that destabilizes me a little bit. What did your younger self think that you might end up doing?
I think my younger self thought that I would probably end up doing this. I didn't have a fixed plan of how it would occur, and I still have no fixed plan of how it occurs. So, if you say, are you a strategist who has managed a career in the church? The answer to that is absolutely not. It has all been so random. I never served in any parish or thought about going there. In fact, until Grangetown was vacant and somebody asked me if I was interested in coming, I had never ever thought of coming to Grangetown. I had never ever thought of going to Margam or Cowbridge or Penarth or Nantymoyne with Wyndham or Llandaff Cathedral or any of those places. It has just all been random. I can't say unplanned is the best way, but I've always gone with the flow, and I suppose that says much about me as a person, that there is no great plan other than probably to get up tomorrow and go for a run.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to end. What a wonderful treat to catch up with you, Edward. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Oh, pleasure. Really nice to catch up with you.